from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. You've probably heard before that the moon landing was fake, or that 9/11 was an inside job. And then there's the current QAnon craze among some supporters of President Donald Trump. Conspiracy theories are thriving in our so-called information age. One recent poll found that 63% of registered voters believe in at least one political conspiracy theory. And experts say that stating the facts doesn't always necessarily help change people's minds. Coming up, Forum looks at the impact and lure of conspiracy theories and what research tells us about who is susceptible to misinformation. That's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It may be the last bipartisan consensus. Voters on both ends of the political spectrum embrace conspiracy theories, whether it's the belief that 9/11 was secretly carried out by the George W. Bush administration or that President Barack Obama was born outside of the United States. Experts find that conspiracy theories often reinforce a pre-existing viewpoint, and confronting believers with verifiable facts can actually entrench their beliefs further. In this hour of Forum, we want to consider the history and allure of conspiracy theories and the latest research on how to change minds. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. I want to welcome, first of all, Joseph Uzinski. He is associate professor of political science at the University of Miami, co-author of a book called American Conspiracy Theories. And welcome to the program, Professor Uzinski.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And also glad to have Eric Oliver, who joins us as well, professor of political science, University of Chicago, author of forthcoming book called Enchanted America. Welcome to the program, Professor Oliver.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And John Vitriol is also with us this morning. He's a psychology fellow at Harvard University. Welcome, Joe Vitriol.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here as well.
And happy to have you. And let me begin with you, if I may,
because
I know there's been a lot of research. And what that research has concluded has to do with system identity threats. And I want to find out a little bit more from you about what that means.
Sure. So system identity threat refers to the perception that society's fundamental defining values are under siege and under threat due to change, perhaps, in society. And this can strengthen people's conspiratorial thinking and their willingness to endorse political conspiracies. And so the perception of system identity threat really concerns the belief that what it means to be an American, what it means to live in American society is undergoing undesirable change, change that is threatening, perhaps volatile, unstable. And this can motivate people to adopt conspiratorial beliefs to explain the causes of that change without perhaps having to revise the way that they're thinking about their values and their identities.
There's also an element in your research that seems to focus on emotionality, or at least in the sense of people trusting their guts or their intuitive emotions more than perhaps their analytical powers or their thinking caps.
Well, it is the case that folks who overestimate their beliefs or confidence in their understanding of politics tend to adopt more conspiratorial ways of thinking. And so we know that people with higher levels of political knowledge tend to have more or less conspiratorial beliefs, and people who are overconfident in their understanding of politics and that overconfidence is unjustified tend to perceive conspiratorial beliefs as more credible and plausible.
And how do we, if I can go to you, Joseph Uzinski, how do we separate conspiracy theories? I mean, some are really palpably absurd by any people's standards, if not ludicrous, and some, you know, have even some merit behind them, or at least a configuration that can be plausible.
Sure, but it's really tough to do, because at the end of the day, we're dealing with ideas that have yet to be given credibility by the institutions that generate and certify new knowledge, right? So an argument between two conspiracy theories, one saying, well, you know, I have good evidence behind me, and the other one saying, I have really good evidence behind me. Well, at the end of the day, both of them are, you know, they could be true, but no one has found good enough evidence to say that they are.
Well, some do turn out true. I mean, Watergate.
So sure.
Iran-Contra.
Some do turn out true, but it's very difficult to say, well, this one's zany and this one isn't, because the believers don't believe that it's zany. Right? And the believers can always pull out some bit of quote-unquote evidence to show you why their conspiracy theory is the true one.
Where do people come up with and sort of follow, almost as if it's a Pied Piper? Well, I'm thinking about Alex Jones, for example, who's been very much in the news lately. Sandy Hook was a conspiracy. It was all a fake. Climate change, we keep hearing from those who deny it. Well, we heard from President Trump that it was actually invented by the Chinese to go against us. These kinds of ideas, you know, are really, in many people's minds, the real deal.
Sure. I mean, belief means belief. When people say, I believe in this, they really do. So we shouldn't look at these beliefs as if, you know, they're purposely picking things that they don't believe just to annoy the rest of us. I mean, these beliefs are sincere and they're genuine for many of these people.
And they cleave to them, so many of them.
Some of it is driven by elites. So it is the case that people like Alex Jones or Donald Trump, people with a soapbox, can get up and share these beliefs widely, and they can spread because a lot of people listen to these folks like Alex Jones.
And we do see this on both sides of the political aisle, though.
Sure, absolutely. And in my work, what I find is that people are equally prone to engaging in conspiratorial thinking, whether they're on the left or right or consider themselves Republicans or Democrats.
This is pretty much consonant with what you found, Eric Oliver. Even though, and the partisan fights, I would add to that, if anything, just exacerbate the kind of beliefs that we see.
Sure. I've been studying conspiracy theories for about 10 years in public opinion, and we see the kind of two categories of public of conspiracy theories that are out there. There are some conspiracy theories that are broadly endorsed across the political spectrum. I'll give you an example. So a large percentage of Americans think that the Food and Drug Administration is deliberately withholding natural cures for cancer because of secret pressure from the pharmaceutical industry. You get equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans endorsing that kind of conspiracy theory. Then you have conspiracy theories that are ideologically tilted. And so, for example, the birther conspiracy theory about Barack Obama was widely endorsed on the right and widely rejected on the left. And the interesting thing is, you know, before Barack Obama was a presidential candidate, nobody was suggesting that he was born outside the United States. And then some rumors get started on these, and these get retransmitted. And then as people are retransmitting these in public discourse, people hear it, and then they say, oh, wow, this kind of validates some of my apprehensions. This may validate my feelings. Yeah, this sounds right to me, and I'll adopt it as a belief.
Well, your work has indicated, I think, that adopting beliefs and coming to those kind of conclusions goes back to maybe the way our brains operate. Huh?
Right. So in the book I have coming out next month called Enchanted America, we make an argument that American politics are not simply organized by ideology or partisanship or race, but also by worldview. And on one side of this worldview, you can imagine people who you would call rationalists, and they have kind of enlightenment perspective. They really look at facts, dispassionate logic, and deduction. On the other side of the spectrum, we would have people we call intuitionists, and these are people who rely on their guts, and if their emotions are signaling something to them, they look in their external world to validate this. And the example I use of this is with my son when he was little, and he would say, well, you know, if there's no monster in the closet, then why am I afraid? And he was looking for narratives and explanations for the world to validate his own feelings. And I think this is what we get with conspiracy theories, is that we find that people who score high on our intuitionism scales, people who have a lot of apprehensions, they have a lot of pessimism, they tend to value symbols and metaphors and take those literally, those types of people are very susceptible to believing and adopting conspiracy theories, because these conspiracy theories coincide with our natural way of making inferences. We tend to think that, oh, if something bad has happened, somebody caused that to happen. It wasn't a consequence of just impersonal or institutional forces. And that tendency to anthropomorphize public events, to look for easy explanations as a means of sort of rationalizing our own feelings of anxiety or discomfort, these are the things that conspiracy theories provide to people, and that's why they're very attractive as beliefs.
Eric Oliver is professor of political science, University of Chicago, co-author of the forthcoming book, Enchanted America, and Joe Vitriol is a psychology fellow at Harvard. And let's talk about susceptibility some more with you, Joe Vitriol, because I think your research has shown that a lot of these people who are susceptible, or the people who are most susceptible, are those who overestimate their own, how shall we put it, understanding of things or intelligence even?
Not necessarily intelligence, but their own causal understanding of political reality. So we know people generally have a superficial understanding of the cause of many phenomena. We know how to turn on our TV, but we don't know how it works. And so the tendency to overestimate how confident we are in our causal understanding of the way that things work could matter for our willingness to adopt perhaps non-conventional perspectives, or perspectives that lack what we would regard to be evidentiary basis. And so we find that when people overstate their or tend to overestimate how strong their causal understanding of the way the political process works, how public policy works, how political institutions operate. These are people who tend to be more receptive to conspiratorial beliefs, and that's particularly true if they lack actual knowledge. So this discrepancy between self-perceived knowledge and actual knowledge tends to really matter for people's willingness to adopt conspiratorial beliefs. And we're beginning to understand why this might be the case, but other findings in the psychological literature concerning who adopts conspiratorial beliefs is consistent with this idea that folks who are skeptical of institutions, are distrusting of the media, tend to have more paranoid orientations, are less trusting in their interpersonal lives, tend to feel politically disenfranchised, or have a kind of cynicism about the way society is operating or how political processes are working, or perceive politicians are acting with corrupt intent, tend to be more receptive to political conspiracies that help rationalize losses in the political realm, help rationalize threat or things that make people feel uncomfortable or anxious. And we observe this across the ideological spectrum, and we do see that both liberals and conservatives have psychological characteristics and traits that predispose them towards adopting political conspiracies. But it's also a top-down process. So the bottom-up process being these psychological traits and characteristics that create motivations and needs that might predispose one towards adopting a conspiratorial belief. And then we have these top-down processes where we have political elites, media outlets, political organizers and political leaders who either themselves believe these conspiracies or view an electoral advantage from inflaming these beliefs, or at the very least not challenging, correcting them.
Yeah, I like what you said at one point when you, you actually said that the best evidence of belief in conspiracies is a belief in other conspiracies.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, there's kind of a chain effect here often.
It is, but it reminds us that this is a general psychological orientation. It's a monolithic type of belief system where folks who believe one conspiracy tend to think in conspiratorial terms, even conspiracies that are contradictory. So there's a really clever line of research by some social psychologists in the UK who find that people who believe that Princess Diana faked her own death also believe that she was murdered, or that people who believe Osama bin Laden was already dead when the U.S. Special Forces raided the compound in Pakistan also believe that he's still alive. These are logically incoherent and directly contradictory sets of beliefs, but what they capture is a tendency to believe that there's a conspiracy, any kind of conspiracy, that the traditional, conventional narrative is incorrect, it's flawed, it's hiding the motivations or the reality of things. And I don't know what the conspiracy is, but it's certainly not what I'm being told. And I will be willing to entertain a broad range of what might seem as bizarre or illogical beliefs to support my assumption that something is awry.
Well, let me go actually to a specific conspiracy, and let me go to you on this, Joseph Uzinski. Again, Joseph Uzinski is associate professor of political science, University of Miami, and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. We've got QAnon very much in the news here, and some are actually objecting to the fact there was a whole article in The Guardian about giving too much credence to conspiracy theorists by actually giving them attention or putting them in the spotlight. But this is the theory that goes something like this. Robert Mueller is not investigating Russian interference in the elections. What he's really investigating is top Democratic involvement in criminal enterprises, including child sex trafficking. And we heard about that back in Pizzagate and so forth. But one wonders, you know, how something like this gets started and how it catches fire. You often think about, I suppose, social media and the Internet. And I'd like to hear from you on this, Joseph Yuzinski.
So these sorts of ideas have always been around. So we had a spark of this a couple of years ago with Pizzagate, where people thought that John Podesta and other high-ranking Democratic officials were running a child sex trafficking ring out of the basement of a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. But if you go back further than that, even before the Internet, we've had problems in this country where people have been accused of running satanic child sex rings and have gone to jail for it. I mean, if you look to the early 90s and late 80s, there were many instances of people running child daycare being accused of doing crazy satanic stuff. And still to this day, we're letting people out of jail for crimes that were never committed. And you can go back through American history and find instances where there's always some idea that someone's doing something really awful to children. And part of the reason why this works, why it's such a motivating conspiracy theory, is because there's nothing worse than sex trafficking of children. It's a horrible thing that makes people angry, and it motivates action. And for that reason, we've seen, you know, somebody go with a gun to a pizza shop. Right now you have a gang of armed men running around the Arizona desert looking for these child sex traffickers. So, you know, this conspiracy theory plays to a small sliver of people, you know, and I have a poll in the field right now, and just looking at the initial results, Q is not coming out with very much support at all. People seem to be overwhelmingly against this. But if you look at the headlines for the last few weeks, it's just been lots and lots of coverage of Q. And the people who believe it see this coverage. And you can look on Twitter and see how they're interpreting it. It only shows how much more important they are. It shows how right they are.
And this becomes sort of a case of true believers, Eric Hoffer used to call them, right?
Well, these people are absolutely true believers. So they are convinced. They are, you know, some of these people are spending time and money. Some of them have got guns ready to foil these child sex traffickers.
And you think social media accelerates this or has accelerated? There's a lot of kind of controversy.
I don't doubt that it accelerates it, but we have to be careful because we like to blame every new communication technology for every social ill, and this has been going on since paper. So just to give you one example, I mean, belief in the Kennedy conspiracy theory was about 80% in the 70s and 80s, and it's down, you know, between 20 and 30 points since then. That's since the Internet came out. You know, just because people can share ideas doesn't mean that they are necessarily accessing those ideas or buying into those
ideas. No, they're getting them faster, getting them a lot faster.
They can, but the tendency, the people who seek this stuff out and the people who buy in are already disposed to seek it out and buy into it. I mean, one example I use is that if you go and type in duck confit recipe, you're going to get 500,000 hits. But no one's racing home to cook duck confit tonight.
That's an interesting example. Let me go back, Eric Oliver, if I could, to you. Let's talk about a little bit with you what can be done about perhaps dissociating or convincing people. I mean, there are people who are hardcore believers in aliens, and there are people who are hardcore in alien control. I'm talking about aliens from outer space. And also people who, for example, are seen as gun control conspirators or conspirators when it comes to the effect of vaccination and all of these different categories. But some, again, in many people's minds, a lot more plausible than others. That's why I initially used the example of the extraterrestrials sort of coming down and landing here in their saucers or whatever, living among us. What can be done to convince people on any part of the spectrum that they need to see things through a factual lens or through the lens of truth?
And that's a very difficult thing to do. And I mean, I think we face something of a dilemma. And democracy, it's a free marketplace of ideas. So people should be willing to, you know, able to have the beliefs or ideas that they want. And the question becomes, you know, when people are starting to have beliefs that have negative public consequences. And so, for example, beliefs in vaccine conspiracies where, you know, we all benefit when everybody else gets vaccines because of herd immunity. And so the question really is, you know, which of these beliefs do we find to have any kind of negative public consequences? And I think we have to be very careful about trying to correct other people and their beliefs. That said, if we do find kinds of beliefs, or we're trying to, you know, speak with people who, for example, embrace different conspiracy theories that we don't, I think the most important thing to do is appreciate what the conspiracy theory is doing for its holder. It's basically offering a way of understanding the world and making the world intelligible to them, and also really reassuring them and playing an important emotional function. And this is the really hard thing with our beliefs, because our beliefs aren't simply just mechanisms for interpreting reality. They're also ways that we make ourselves feel comfortable, make ourselves feel secure. And so the idea that we can sort of sit down and reason with someone and reason out their conspiracy theory, I think, is going to be very, very challenging. It goes back to, I said earlier, the example of my son and the monster in the closet. I couldn't convince him that there was no monster in the closet. He had a rationalization for, you know, why it was there, even I couldn't see it. But what I could do is hear his concerns and listen to his concerns and empathize with him.
You're talking about empathy here.
Yeah.
Some of these ideas are, in many people's minds, so far-fetched or don't have evidence that it's very difficult for them to empathize. And yet I think, Joseph Yuzinski, if I'm not mistaken, you've made an important point about not only empathizing, but really putting on the different glasses and seeing it from the other point of view.
Yeah, and it is, as you say, very difficult to do, you know, but I have family members, some of whom believe that there are child sex traffickers who are Satanists and who are embedded in the Democratic Party. And I have to have Thanksgiving with these people. And
good luck.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, we all have to get along with each other. And unless we're going to seal ourselves into little bubbles, we are going to come across people who believe in conspiracy theories that we don't agree with. And some of them we will think as very extreme or completely unevidenced. And one way that I could put it is this, that people are all coming to their opinions in similar ways. Even though they get to a different place, we're all sort of doing the same thing. Is that we have a set of dispositions that we have that come out of our upbringing that tell us how we interpret the world, and then that helps us interpret new information that we receive along the way. So everyone does this, and we try to do it as best we can with the amount of time that we have and with the quality of information that we have. And because those things are so variable, some people are going to get better answers and other people are going to get worse answers, but we're all sort of doing the same thing. There's another point here, too.
Professor Yuzinski, hold that point because I have to go to a break, and I want to also find out from Joe Vitriol a little bit about how we can actually maybe change people's minds. I think he has some thoughts on that. But I know you, our listeners, have some thoughts about conspiracy theories and have some questions and comments. And I'd like to maybe ask if you've ever believed in a conspiracy theory. The numbers are staggering of people who do. And if so, what changed your mind? Or you may just want to talk about what we're talking about in general, which is where do they come from, how are they propagated, and what can be done to really dissuade people, particularly if they could be people in power who can do harm. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about conspiracy theories, which are thriving and which are out there on a whole spectrum. We have a number of experts with us on a panel. Eric Oliver, professor of political science at University of Chicago and co-author of a book that's forthcoming called Enchanted America, and Joe Vitriol, who's a psychology fellow at Harvard, and Joseph Yuzinski, who's associate professor of political science at University of Miami, co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. You are welcome to join the program and join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Again, you can do that by dialing in toll-free at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. You can also post on our website, kqed.org/forum. and go to this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle, again, is at KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Let me go, Joseph Yuzinski, back to you. You had another point to make before we came up on the break, so please finish if you would.
So Eric Oliver, for example, I'll cite his paper, they ask about 7 conspiracy theories, and they wound up with more than 50% of the country endorsing one of them. So that's a pretty high number, but there are an unlimited number of conspiracy theories out there that people can believe in. So we shouldn't think of conspiracy theorists as a them. You know, we all fit that category if conspiracy theorist means anyone who believes in any conspiracy theory.
Well, you've whetted my curiosity. Let me ask Professor Oliver, what was the one that most people agreed on, Eric Oliver?
The most popular one is about the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah.
It's around 40% of the people, of the American public that we've surveyed, believes in that. That the Food and Drug Administration is deliberately withholding natural cures for cancer. Other popular ones include, when we were surveying, this was back before President Trump was elected, usually around 20 to 25% of the public believed that President Obama was faking his birth certificate. You get usually around 20, anywhere between 17 to 20% of people agreeing that 9/11 was an inside job. These tend to be the most popular ones.
Isn't there also a popular one about the federal budget goes to paying interest on the national debt, over half of the federal budget? That's been out there for quite some time, and of course it's not true.
Yeah, but I don't know if that counts as a conspiracy theory. I think it's important when we define what we mean by conspiracy theory here, which is that the idea that some event is happening because there's some secretive, nefarious group that has ill intention and is causing something bad to happen, you know, for their secretive plot there. So unless the deficit one is the interest on the debt conspiracy, I mean, I think we need to differentiate between what might be misinformation and conspiracy
theories.
Yeah,
I appreciate that differentiation and distinction. And let me, before I go to our callers, Joe Vitri, I'll go back to you and find out from you, again, what can be done to change people's minds? I mean, you know, we're not necessarily out there trying to de-proselytize or something along those lines, but people sometimes need to be presented facts and they don't budge.
Of course, and this is the million-dollar question. Changing people's minds is very difficult. And that's especially true for beliefs or opinions that are held with strong level of conviction or represent a core part of people's identities and their self-concepts. And conspiratorial beliefs are one of a broader class of what political scientists might describe as political misperceptions. And we know that correcting what might be factually or normatively incorrect beliefs is very difficult and very challenging, often backfires. Confronting people with factual information that is inconsistent with their pre-existing assumptions often just motivates them to counter-argue and to rationalize away the information, and that could actually increase their convictions. When it comes to conspiracy beliefs, this is even more challenging because efforts to correct inaccurate perceptions or factually misleading beliefs become part of the conspiracy, become subsumed in the broader conspiratorial orientation. This isn't to say that people aren't responsive to factual information and how they think. It's just very difficult to do so, and to do so in a constructive way. And some promising lines of research suggest that the source of that information really matters, because conspiratorial beliefs often function to represent one's own group in a favorable way, or represent an opposing group in an unfavorable way, in addition to providing a meaningful explanation for a threatening event. When corrective information comes from somebody within my own group, I tend to be more responsive to it, more receptive of it. It undermines my perceived legitimacy that this is information or opinions that I should adopt. The issue, and I alluded to this earlier, is getting members of one's own group to correct political misperceptions that might benefit political leaders in their electoral goals.
Well, let me say
this is a million-dollar question.
It is a million-dollar question. We'll hear from listeners, and maybe some of the listeners can provide some light on this as you see it. I can assure you, though, that the three guests we have and I are not conspiring here this morning. It's the first time I've actually talked to them, and let's talk with some of you, and let's go to your calls. Let's begin with Neil, who's calling us from up in Alberta, Canada. Welcome, Neil.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi. Go ahead.
I don't believe, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, or I'm real skeptical anyway. And my son, he buys into the 9/11 thing and the conspiracy there. And whenever I tell him, he's talking through his hat. he gets all grumpy and tells me I got to do my research, i.e. check it out on the internet, which is, in my opinion, a bunch of crap. But, you know, but one of my questions is the alt-right spends a lot of time and effort catering to, but, you know, a lot of them don't have any listeners. What's the deal?
Well, let's go to we've got a political science professor here with us, Joseph Yuzinski. You have some thoughts about the alt-right and what they actually derive from their conspiracy theories?
Well, in some ways, they're just like anyone else. They want to spread their ideas. Sometimes they want to manipulate others with information. Sometimes they want to troll other people. But not all of the conspiracy stuff that we see on the internet is from the alt-right. I mean, some of it is from, you know, Russian operatives who put this out there, some of whom do it for, you know, political reasons, some of whom do it for money. So I you know, I was in Europe this summer talking to people who are trying to work, you know, work with this problem that they have of a lot of highly trained men that don't have jobs that wind up getting recruited by Russia to spread fake news. So, you know, some of this is alt-right people who like to go onto Reddit and say weird stuff. Some of it is more calculated.
You said something that I think is worth repeating, because it's actually pretty funny on the one hand, but it probably would also get a lot of people agitated. And that is when we asked you about there being more conspiracy theories on the right, you said just go to Whole Foods sometime and see what they're doing. I think you've said this in print as well, what they're doing with GMOs. And this comes off of a program just in our last segment that had to do with a recent, we had the vice president of Monsanto talking about a case that was lost, Monsanto being often identified with GMOs. But, you know, there are people who think when you call GMOs a conspiracy, you're on the side of corporate power and you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I've been called that more recently because of all the coverage of the Q conspiracy. I've been called a Satanist deep stater. So the fact that I don't agree with these people on their conspiracy theories often raises their ire, and they will accuse me of being, you know, willfully ignorant or in on it. And, you know, one thing with the GMOs is that not everyone buys into the GMO conspiracy, but there's the conspiracy has been somewhat successful at pushing fear of GMOs. So, you know, the science says that these are safe. But for whatever reason, you have a lot of people who think, oh, no, it's the corporations who are trying to poison us.
Yeah, well, that was the point I was raising here. Let me get some more callers on with us, and Daniel joins us next. Daniel, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think it's really important to differentiate between belief that's not based on evidence and a healthy skepticism of sources, particularly official sources. You know, during the time when we were being told that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, you know, it was the White House, the State Department, and the New York Times. And Judith Miller wrote article after article explaining how Saddam had WMDs, and it turned out to be a complete fabrication. I think maybe your guests have a widely held uncommon bias, which is that if it's in the Times or it's coming out from an official source, you know, a government agency or whatever, it must be true, and we don't have to look any further. And I'd like to suggest that for a lot of the American public, we've learned not only to distrust a lot of the media, but to distrust a lot of official sources as well. You know, Monsanto is not a credible source. And I think your guests, if they say all the science says GMOs are safe, haven't done their research. The jury is out. There's some evidence of risk associated with GMOs. It's not conclusive. But if you choose just to believe Monsanto or just to believe one official agency, then you've got another unconscious bias that's in its own way as irrational as that of people who believe wild conspiracy theories.
Well, you raised some important points, Daniel. I want to get, in fact, to Professor Oliver to respond to the importance that you pointed out between distinguishing between believing things without evidence and what you called healthy skepticism. Eric Oliver?
Yeah, I think the important thing is, how do we go about asserting, in determining truth claims, and how do we go about determining evidence? I don't think any of us here are suggesting that, the New York Times is infallible in its truth claims. I think what we're interested in is, why are people embracing narratives, in this case conspiracy theories or explanations for events, that oftentimes seem to fly in the face of a lot of accumulated evidence or strong evidence to the contrary here? And, you know, what we've been trying to figure out is, well, what breaks down in this kind of failure of rationality here? And the answer is oftentimes, as I think as Joe Yashinsky was saying, it has to do with our prior predispositions. You know, what are we bringing to the table when we're encountering new information? What is it that's out there that's validating our prior conceptions? I think one of the challenges that we have in our current climate is because there's such mistrust in media right now, and so much skepticism in the news sources, people really don't know what to believe. And, you know, in that instant uncertainty, it generates a lot of anxiety. And I think in the case of that anxiety, it leaves people very, very susceptible to transgressive messages that, you know, may seem intuitively plausible, but, you know, and you could probably find some breadcrumb of facts to support it, quote-unquote facts to support it, but it's really not any more of a factual explanation than, say, what would be a conventional explanation that's out there.
But we'll go back to Joe Vitriol on this, a psychology fellow from Harvard. I mean, often it's just comforting to believe that you understand things and that you have this trenchant insight into things that really matter.
Oh, that's right. I mean, people definitely want to feel confident in their understanding about the world. Lacking confidence, lacking certainty can be very threatening and can motivate biases in how people process information. And the conspiratorial domain is a great example of that. We observe folks adopting conspiratorial beliefs because they satisfy psychological needs to reduce their uncertainty, to reduce their perception of threat. And this can be a major motivator for all kinds of ways of thinking. But there's an important distinction between, I think, skepticism of information and denial of credible information. It's of course the case that at some point in time, a conspiratorial belief that has been advanced, that has gained popularity, comes to be found to be somewhat true or credible, whatever it might be. It's important to remember that folks aren't necessarily arriving at these beliefs based on a credible or logical or coherent analysis of all the available information. Often the judgment of what constitutes credible information or what is accurate is subjective and is a reflection of psychological needs and motivations and people's predispositions. We're not objective, cold information processors. We're motivated in how we think, and information can be subjected to the biases that are introduced by those motivations. And so when people adopt conspiratorial beliefs, they're doing so because it satisfies a broad range of motivations and needs, one of which might be to be accurate and objective, but others could be to express one's identity, express one's values, to reduce threat, to feel part of a group. And so it's absolutely the case that government agencies lie, that the media may be inaccurate, that politicians may misrepresent information, and that we may find over time that a conspiracy is actually a credible account of objective and observable reality. But there's a difference between rationality and rationalization, and I think often what we're seeing in the case of conspiracies are rationalizations of threat or anxiety that people are experiencing in a complex and consequential domain, and that would be, of course, politics.
Yeah, in fact, I recall a wise friend of mine once saying, if you believe in these political conspiracies that are so convoluted often and labyrinthine, just remember that the people you're attributing the conspiratorial powers to aren't necessarily all that bright to have figured out what is being attributed to them. Joseph Yashinsky, comment from a listener wants to know, let me read his comment. It's Kyler who writes, "In my experience, the more privileged someone is, the more prone they are to believing conspiracy theories, which makes me think people follow them more as a hobby. I'm from a liberal white area, and vaccine and chemtrail conspiracies are broadly accepted in the wealthier crowd." And there's data about this. I mean, in terms of accepting even things like vaccinations causing all kinds of problems that have been, they're still moot at best, particularly autism, which is not moot, I don't think. These kinds of theories do go better in wealthier communities, more affluent communities.
Well, some do. So, and the interesting thing is people pick and choose which conspiracy theories they're going to believe in. So you had a outbreak of measles in California a few years ago because somebody came in with it, and then a lot of the people there weren't getting vaccinated. But these are college-educated, smart people who knew better, but because they were getting alternative information, and they, you know, they had a thing for alternative medicine and alternative ways of thinking, and they were going to not get the vaccines for their kids or for themselves, and then you wind up with dead people. But it happens. It happens with all walks of life. I mean, there was a church in Texas where the pastor said, "Don't get vaccinated. God doesn't want you to." And then they got hit with measles.
Yeah, I'm looking at a comment from a listener who says, some of us consider God a grand conspiracy theory. It's interesting. I mean, just dovetailing on what you just said. And in fact, do you know if there's any difference in gender in terms of conspiracy susceptibility to conspiracy theories?
In my research, in terms of underlying conspiracy thinking, none. And I could give you a good example. So if you look at the TV show The View, I mean, a lot of the hosts espoused conspiracy theories. Jenny McCarthy was an anti-vaxxer. Whoopi Goldberg thought that the moon landing was faked. And Rosie O'Donnell thought that jet fuel didn't melt steel.
Let me bring on more callers. We go to you next. Corey, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a therapist in Oakland, and kind of cults and conspiracy theories and things have always interested me since I was even in college. And I would say Alan Moore has a great quote regarding conspiracy theories as a more comfortable alternative to people than the idea that we're on a ship sailing through the cosmos without a rudder. And, I would say even in my experience as a therapist, that's what I've noticed. And I think, you know, when we look at a lot of these things like the FDA conspiracy and vaccine conspiracies, what I see is that people are far more comfortable with the idea that there is some insidious plot to roll these things rather than the idea that, you know, cancer is a part of life that we just have to accept, or that, you know, autism is a part of the human experience and that it might even be a good one, you know, but I think people are far more comfortable with the ideas that these are, you know, insidious things being ran by somebody rather than really just part of life and something that we have to kind of learn to adapt to and live with.
Corey, I thank you for those remarks. I'm just going to let them stand and go right to another caller, and that's you, Robbie. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So sure. my first gripe is, so I just have like one gripe with this conversation, and it's probably just because we're talking about politically motivated conspiracy theories and just conspiracy theories in general. It's almost like you guys are painting people who believe in conspiracy theories as irrational, and that they have like paranoia, mental problems, like almost schizophrenic. But
nobody said anything about schizophrenia. I didn't hear that. But emotionally, emotional.
Yeah, irrational. Like they're out to get me almost, and that's kind of like why I mentioned schizophrenia. But I entertain conspiracy theories just because like I think they're fun just as a person. I like to entertain like neutral, like the society conspiracy theories. I think vaccination conspiracy theories are somewhat dangerous to society because people won't get vaccinated. But I wanted to bring up an example, like aliens on the moon. Like that's a conspiracy theory. I'll entertain aliens on the moon. Like, I'm going to sound crazy, but like aliens on the moon using the moon as a moon base. Like, I'm going to entertain that conspiracy theory because like I've never been on the moon. I don't know. Like I'd have to like the only reason why I wouldn't believe that is because NASA or whatever official report NASA puts out tells me that, hey, there aren't.
I know what you're getting at here, Robbie. And that is, a couple of points, and I'd like to go to Eric Oliver on this, that conspiracy theories can be fun. I mean, just the imagination that's involved in them. And sometimes they can also be enlightening and teach you a good deal.
Well, and they can be compelling. And I'm going to go back to the previous point about, like, you know, conspiracy theories amongst the affluent and on the left. And, you know, one of the reasons why a lot of leftists embrace conspiracy theories about natural foods or vaccines or natural medicine is because they're sort of intuitive concerns about nature and cleanliness and purity and really embracing those. Those are,
you know, we are hardwired to be very, very concerned with toxins and contaminants in our environment. And so when we're very, very sensitive to cues about these types of things. And so if you have a conspiracy theory that says, oh, someone's deliberately poisoning us or doing something that's quote-unquote unnatural, you know, it's going to be very, very compelling for us. And I think there's the other thing that's interesting about conspiracy theories is sometimes that they're something of a puzzle. If you look at the QAnon conspiracy theory, it's, you know, it's these little driblets of information from this person, Q, who was sending out, you know, secretive messages that were cryptic and hard to decipher. And yeah, people like to engage in them. There was something of a puzzle. It's, if you think about how many of our movies and our films and TV shows are about the conspiracy theory and, the, you know, the hero is, you know, deciphering the plot and figuring out what's going on.
Yeah, Hollywood has a lot to do with this, doesn't it, Eric?
Yeah. And so, you know, the conspiracy theorist can put, you know, him or herself in the role of that hero. And it's like, oh, wow, I'm Jack Bauer.
Interesting. Let me go to another caller, and let's welcome our next caller. And it's you, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. Some of your guests mentioned earlier that there are certain kind of political and social conditions that may make people more susceptible to believing in certain conspiracy theories. And I wonder if they've studied any historical trends over time or looked at certain kind of eras where there was, you know, political or social instability, for instance, you know, a time and place where there was people were living under dictatorship and where finding credible information was difficult. Do we see in those times, and for instance, in our own era right now, where kind of the very foundations of truth are being actively undermined by the Trump administration, that people become more susceptible to believing in conspiracy theories simply because good information is more difficult to find?
It's a good question, and particularly taking a historical view. Can you help us here, Joe Vitrell?
Oh, absolutely. I think under conditions of threat, instability, uncertainty,
volatility,
when people lack confidence in traditional sources of information, not only the media, but also universities and scientists, then the potential for adopting conspiratorial beliefs are greater. I'm going to steal Dr. Uzinski's thunder here and note that often the case is that people who are out of political power and disenfranchised adopt more conspiratorial beliefs. And he quite famously has written that conspiracy theories are for losers, and that when people feel lacking in control in important life domains, when they feel disenfranchised or not able to meaningfully participate in the political process, or feel as though society is changing in ways that they find disagreeable, the potential for distrust of traditional sources of information, the willingness to at least entertain what might otherwise be regarded as relatively extreme kinds of beliefs or bizarre kinds of beliefs increases. And perhaps we're in that moment right now. There's a lot of volatility. There's a lot of polarization. There's a lot of change. Members of traditionally disenfranchised groups have in recent years perhaps become more empowered and have been given greater voice, and that's threatening to the other folks as well. And so we're in a very volatile and unstable time that creates uncertainty, creates threats, and these are conditions we know to increase the willingness to adopt conspiracy theories, and also undermines the effectiveness of institutions, of information sources that we might normatively regard to be credible. It undermines the effectiveness of those institutions to perhaps interject and present a more credible, more civil way of discussing these issues.
Again, Joe Vitrell is psychology fellow at Harvard University, and he mentioned your work, Joseph Uzinski. This may be another one of those million-dollar questions, but what do we know about conspiracy theories and the link to violence?
So people who engage in this in conspiratorial thinking at the very high end, they tend to be more accepting of violence against government in our surveys. And what other studies find is that people who engage in this sort of thinking are also they also see conspiring themselves as an appropriate way to achieve their own ends. And they are in favor of more lax gun laws. So you put all that together. People who think that, you know, there's a powerful force out to get us, they are okay with violence against government, and they like guns, and they want to conspire to achieve their own ends. Every once in a while, you're going to get somebody who fights fire with fire. And the person who went to the pizza shop with a loaded gun is an example of that. Timothy McVeigh is an example of that.
Another quick question to you, Joseph Yuzinski. Leslie, one of our listeners, says, you think that we alluded to this before. I'd like to know just your thoughts quickly. You think continual repetition by the media reporting on these conspiracy theories has the consequence of reinforcing people's belief in them?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think this Q coverage is probably not going to get more Q believers. But I think in the case with Sandy Hook, that was sort of pulled from a person's website and then given a prominent spot on CNN. And I think that sparked a lot of the false flag rhetoric that we see now.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I want to express appreciation to the three people we had with us this morning. Joseph Yuzinski, thank you for joining us. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Joseph Yuzinski, again, is Associate Professor of Political Science, University of Miami, co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. And Eric Oliver, thank you for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Eric Oliver is Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, co-author of the forthcoming book, Enchanted America. And Joe Vitriol, good to have you as well. Thank you for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Joe Vitriol is Psychology Fellow at Harvard University. And we are Forum, and we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11 in the morning. An hour is repeated in the evening. You can, indeed, we encourage you to continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And certainly always want to hear from you. If you have some thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. We'll be back with you on the morrow. Rick Wilson is joining us in the second hour tomorrow, one of the founders of the Never Trump movement, a former Republican strategist. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.